For our first featured speaker of the evening, will you welcome, please, from San Pedro, California, Tori Heasley Zankinch.
Hi, I'm Tori, an alcoholic, and it's a really, really great to be here. Seriously, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much, Carol, for thinking of Vince and I, and for inviting us to come up. And we've had so much. We like Visalia so much. Seriously, we're staying an extra day. We were gonna go home after tomorrow, but we're gonna stay an extra day and enjoy ourselves. I love the countryside. I had to go pet the horse, and you know, you're just in God's heaven, I guess. I want to welcome the newcomers, in particular. I know that I have a bit of years. I got sober in 1987, and when I watched everybody stand up, and when we did the countdown, it made me think of my early sobriety when I had a calendar. When I got sober, and I used to mark off every day, every 24 hours that I could get through was a challenge. You know, I when I came into the program, I had was a daily drinker. I grew up in the 60s, so I can't say that was all I did. There was a lot of other things to do, and I did them. You know, I had no moral compass when I got sober. I grew up in a good family. I had a Catholic upbringing. My parents were divorced, and my brother and I, I'm going to switch to my early years now. My brother and I, we and my mother went to live with my grandparents, and my grandfather was a wonderful man. He was a motion picture producer. He was retired, and he got actually the first Academy Award ever given. But he was a real humble man. He never talked about his career, and he loved my brother and I. And we lived in Beverly Hills in a big house, and we had a cook and a maid and a dog, and you know, again, we went to Catholic schools, grade school. I went to a Catholic high school, an all-girls school, and you know, nobody, I would have never thought, no one in my family would have ever thought that I would end up having to go to Alcoholics Anonymous because I was drinking every day, and I, again, said I had no moral compass whatsoever. And I didn't tell anybody at first that I came to AA. You know, I really didn't want to go to, I didn't want to quit drinking. It was pretty much, I couldn't imagine life without drinking. I couldn't imagine, and my whole life revolved around it. The people that I hung out with were, you know, addicts and alcoholics, and, you know, I never went to jail. Not that I shouldn't have, but I never. That wasn't in my, that wasn't part of my journey here. You know, and you know, I was just trying to think of, you know, the last week. May is my birthday month. I have a natal birthday is May 25th. I turned 70 last year. And my AA birthday is May 27th. So you can imagine what my last drunk was like. You know, I went out on May 25th, and I had not been drinking for a week because I was trying so hard not to drink. And I ended up going out with another couple. They said, well, we'll take you out. So we ended up having to wait at the bar and for our table. And, you know, it was before I knew it, I was asking for a drink and another drink and another drink. And I ended up not eating much of my dinner, spending a lot of time in the bathroom, leaving late that night from the bar, going over to my boyfriend's house, which he was not really my boyfriend. He had told me that distinctly when I got over there. And, you know, he was 15 years younger than me. And, you know, I got to, and I knocked on that door, and he opened it up at like 2 in the morning and said, you know, like, what are you doing? You know, real nasty to me. And I thought, you know, the next day I felt that huge demoralization. It was just like all came to me. It was not like the first time I had done things that were demoralizing, believe me, but it was the last time, and I just couldn't take it. I couldn't bear it, you know. And I was working in a shoe store, and I was working alone. I was in the bathroom all most of the day, and I just said, I can't do this anymore. And I had taken, you know, that 15, you know, year younger boyfriend, I had called a treatment center for him, and to try to get hold of his cocaine problem and his sexual abuse problem, or sexual whatever it is problem. I had gone to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had taken my brother to an AA meeting, and was so glad that I could leave, because, you know, I certainly didn't want to be like those people. But anyway, so I knew something of the program, and I didn't want to quit drinking. And then, but it was like this last, if you had asked me like the night before if I wanted to quit drinking and doing what I was doing, I would have said, no, I'm okay. You know, my life's all right. You know, it's okay that I'm living, working in a shoe store. I'm offering, you know, I know, outside issue stuff to my employees, that my boss had to come to me and tell me not to do that anymore, and that I had stolen from my employer, and I had stolen from, I worked as a flight attendant for 18 years, and boy, I had a lot of amends to make them, financial amends for those little bottles. And I, you know, if you had asked me if I, you know, needed to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, if I needed to quit drinking, you know, I would have not said so. And then, you know, this last thing with my birthday, I knew. And I knew that I had to do something. And I called my chiropractor, who I knew had gotten sober, because when I used to go to the chiropractor, he always smelled of wine and alcohol. And then, you know, one day he seemed okay, and he told me he had gone to Alcoholics Anonymous. So when I decided that I wanted to do something about my drinking, and that I really needed help, I really needed help, because I had tried many times to quit on my own. I would go like 10 days, 3 days, you know, maybe, you know, even I think I tried to do it for 30 days, like was suggested to me, and I did it. And I always said to myself, oh, okay, I did it. You know, it's not a problem. But, you know, it just got worse. And so I called my chiropractor, and he said, well, come over. I just happen to have somebody over here that is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and her name was Judy Balch. And I know her today. You know, that was 28 years ago. And we go to the same meeting today, And so what I did is she took me to my first few meetings, and my first meeting was it was called The Week That Was, and it was in Lawndale, and out in front of the, you know, it was at a civic center, and out in front of the meeting hall were like about, I don't know, 20 bikes, you know, biker bikes. And I went into the meeting, and, you know, everybody there were, you know, most everybody there, it looked like a men's stag, but most everybody there, you know, they had their, you know, biker stuff on. And the only familiarity I had with, you know, I'd been in a bar with my brother once. I used to love to hang out with my brother because my brother was an alcoholic as well. And he used to go to the bars that had sawdust on the floor, and I could play pool and, you know, meet those bad boys. And, you know, and then one time, you know, the bike, you know, the guys in there, things came in, and my brother got, and I don't know, he was trying to stick up for the bartender, and it became a big mess. So that was my only experience. And so when I went into this meeting, and these guys were sitting in there, and they started talking about the spirituality of the disease, and they were talking about what they were doing to make their life better, and that they were working steps, that they had a sponsor, and that they were, you know, gentlemen today. You know, it was like I had never... I was just in awe, you know. And so the next meeting I went to was my home group, which is South Bay Survivors Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's in Redondo Beach, and that's where I found I have my sponsor, Franny Smith, and she's still my sponsor today. And she was the meeting. We have a big South Bay Roundup, and it's in September, and if you get a flyer, you should, if you get down to our neck of the woods, seriously, it is the most fun. It's like a whole weekend event, and speakers, and, you know, dances, and what might the South Bay Survivors Group, for me, they went to a lot of conventions out of town. They went to the Roundup. We went to dances. We had barbecues. And each one of us, you know, several of us took, we never wanted a holiday to be not covered with a party. You know, we wanted newcomers or, you know, all of us, we wanted a sober place. We wanted to be around sober people. And so we would cover Thanksgiving and Christmas Eve and New Year's Day. And we had all the holidays covered, and we'd have a party. And today my husband and I, we still carry that tradition. We have our New Year's Day party. And if you're in Long Beach, you're invited. And sober. Well, yeah. You know. And we have a lot of fun today. And most of all of our friends are that we hang out with, you know, we do things with. Are sober, you know. I guess if I were to offer any, you know, I'll tell you what I did when I got sober. I just hung out. I stayed really close to my sponsor. You know, I started marking off those days on my calendar. And when I got to about 190 days, you know, I stopped using the calendar. And it got uncomfortable for me, like about 9 months, because, you know, just because I got sober didn't mean I was not doing the things that made me feel bad about myself. So I started, worked with my sponsor, and I started working on my steps, and I started learning somewhat about myself. And what I realized is that, because I was always feeling hurt, and I was always feeling guilty, and I had heard that if I would work the fourth step, you know, number one, I might stay sober. Number two, I might not stay sober if I don't. And the other is that I would find, be able to look at my responsibility and some of the things that were, had hurt me and some of the people that had hurt me. And I would be able to take responsibility, and so that I might be able to avoid repeating those things. And that's what's happened. You know, I think it's about time for me to quit, but I love my life today. I really, really love my life today. It's my life is not perfect. I have had things in sobriety that have been very difficult. You know, I've lost my brother. He died at 54, and I was so close with him. And my mother passed. And you know, life events, you know, happen. And what is so wonderful about Alcoholics Anonymous is that you people, you know, understand that you understood me when I first came in. You knew I was crazy, but you loved me anyway, you know. And there was that saying, you know, let us love you until you could love yourself. And that fit me so perfectly, because all I did was cry when I first got here. You know, there's no way I could have stood up in front of anybody and talked. All I did was look at the ground. And in meetings, all I did was cry. You know, and it's very different today. I went back to school. I got a degree. And I began in a profession that I could help people, not as an alcohol counselor, but people that their lives had been seriously affected by alcohol and drugs to the point where, you know, they lost a lot of things, including their children. Yeah, and it's so hard to see that. So, you know, stick with the winners. You know, get a sponsor. Don't feel, you know, try not to feel ashamed that you're an alcoholic or an addict. I mean, you know, the first thing I had to realize that I had to tell the truth of what I was and what my life was about. And from then on, you know, my life could get better with the help of the 12 steps and the people in these rooms and a sponsor and people that love you. Because, you know, we all love one another, and our purpose here is to help one another. Thank you.
It is time for our featured speaker of the evening. Ladies and gentlemen in attendance, and sober alcoholics around the world, it's sober time! And now please show our Tulare County gratitude for all the way from San Pedro, California, with 32 years of sobriety, it's Vin Zankage!
Almost fell down right there, you know. My name's Vince, I'm an alcoholic. And it's always a pleasure to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and especially to get an introduction like that, you know. And in addition to that, we've been treated like kings and queens since we've been up here. And from the bottom of my heart, man, we appreciate that, you know, for taking care of us and with respect to that. So I want to thank Carol and Rick all the way. You know, Rick, I know you're going to listen to the tape, so I thought I'd mention your name, you know. And also, we had a meeting last night, that Friday night meeting, and it was so similar to the meeting that we used to attend in San Pedro, you know, and it kind of flabbergasted me a little bit, you know. And also, there was a guy named Anthony, and I forgot his wife's name already, and he said he was going to listen to the tape. Couldn't make it tonight, so I'll mention his name as well, so when he hears the tape, he gets to hear his name, you know. And the best thing about him, you know, listening to the tape, he knows what I look like, you know, so. Yeah. Anyway. anyway, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, see, you know. If it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd be dead today, and I know that. And there's probably a few other people here tonight as well that feel probably the same way, you know. And I might say a few four-letter words, you know, but if I do, just kind of like, you know, don't say anything about it, you know, it's okay. But I'll try not to. My wife always tells me, Vince, don't swear when you get up there, you know. But anyway, that reminds me of a little bit of a little joke between this priest and a nun, you know, and they're out golfing. So I love the big book, but it's in my way right now. But anyway, this priest and nun are golfing together, and then you go about the third hole, you know, and the priest misses about a 10-foot putt, and he goes, "Oh, shoot!" You know, but not shoot, he didn't say. And the nun goes, "Father, what are you doing? Don't be swearing like that, you know. If you keep that up, man, God's going to strike lightning down. He's going to knock you out and going to kill you right here on the spot." And he goes, okay, sister, I'm sorry, you know. And they go a couple of more holes, and he shanks one to the left and to the right into the bushes, you know. And he goes, "Ah, shit, excuse me." And the sister goes, "Father, what are you doing? You know, God's going to strike lightning down you and kill you right here on the spot." And he goes, "Oh, I'm sorry, you know, I'm sorry. You know, I won't do it again, sister, you know." So they go up a few more holes, you know, and he misses another 10-foot putt, and he goes, "Ah, shit." And all of a sudden, boom, strike of lightning comes down and hits the nun. You know, and she's down. He goes, "Oh, man." You know, and the priest hears a little rumbling upside, you know, and boom. And this voice comes on and goes, "Oh, shit." So, you know, we're all not perfect, you know what I mean? So somebody, you know, if I slip, I slip, you know. But, you know, I'm the real alcoholic variety, you know, as we say. And you know, for the people that are new here tonight, you know, and it doesn't take, you know, 20 years of drinking to be a real alcoholic, you know. You can drink for maybe a week or 10 years or 5 years or 2 months or 3 months, and you qualify to be a real alcoholic. And you know, if you take that first drink, and you want another drink, and another drink, and another drink, you might be up here someday talking just like me, you know, because then you're a real alcoholic, see. It's like, you know, we don't say, you know, "I think I'll take this drink, and I'll go out and get a drunk driving tonight," you know. We take that first drink, and we think about, "Man, how good it's going to make me feel inside," see. We don't realize we've got the obsession of the mind coupled with the phenomenon of craving. And once we take that first drink, we want another drink and another drink and another drink, see. We don't reach over and grab that drink and all of a sudden you might be on one of them horses over there. You know, you wake up and you're in Texas somewhere, you know. You know, "How'd I get here?" See. And you're a real alcoholic, see. It doesn't take 100 drinks, it takes one drink. One's too many, 1,000's not enough, see. And I qualified. I didn't know about that before I got on Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm the kind of drinker that I take that first drink and I keep on going, I keep on going, I keep on going, see. From 1972 to when I got sober, March the 1st in 1984, I got 7 drunk drive-ins. And I didn't think I had a problem, you know. They asked me, I remember when I got my license suspended, you know, and the guy asked me when I tried to get my license back after about 6-7 years after I got sober and stuff, you know, they asked me if I ever had blackouts. And I says, "Yeah, I have blackouts, you know." And he goes, "Did you go to the doctor?" Man, who goes to the doctor after a blackout, you know? And, you know, the next thing I want to do, I want to take another drink, man, so I can, you know, try to get going again, see? But that's, you know, we don't think like that, see? We don't think like that. So after I got my sixth drunk driving, you know, in those days they didn't send you to jail right away, you know, and you could get out of the drunk driving, they knock them down to reckless driving and that if you had a few dollars, you know, and so that's what happened with me. And after the sixth one, I went to jail for 48 hours, and it was the worst 48 hours of my life, you know. I need to mention the fact that I'm also an ex-convict. I spent a lot of time in prison and in jails. And from the age of 18 to 36, I was probably outside maybe 3 years in that period of time. And for numerous and sundry charges. But, you know, I think I'll share one little thing about that is the fact that, you know, there's a lot of new people here tonight, and a lot of times we drink and we go into bars and most alkies got wise mouths, you know, we like to talk stuff, as we like to say, you know, and a lot of times we get a lot of fights and we try to hurt somebody and that's what happened to me. And I was 22 years old and I got in a fight with a guy in a bar and he never got up. You know, he died right on the spot. And the whole motive of that story is the fact that, you know, it doesn't matter who you are, what you're doing. If you go, you whack somebody, then you might hurt them. You might hurt them bad, see? And that's I need to admit that was part of the reason why I went to prison. And I don't talk about that much, but that's what happened. And it's just like a warning, you know, it's a warning. And but what happened is I went after that sixth drunk driving. You know, I was in jail for 48 hours, and it killed me. I couldn't stand it. And I got out of there, and the first thing I said, you know, I'm staying living with this lady and a couple of kids we had, you know, and I said, I'm going to quit drinking, you know. Nobody's ever said that here before, right? I'm going to quit drinking, you know. And what happened is, you know, I went on a marijuana maintenance program, you know. And, you know, after, I'm the kind of drunk that when you take the booze away from me or anything else, you know, I'm like, you're one of these kind of guys, you know. And then in those days, they didn't have the boom, boom, boom remote control for a television. You had to go up and boom, boom, and change the channel, you know. And I'm like, you know, I'm going, chon, chon, changing the channel every 5 minutes, and I couldn't sit still. So the lady I'm with comes home from the market one night, sits down a six-pack of Michelob, half pint of Southern Comfort. She goes, drink that. I said, all right. And there I went. Next week, I got my seventh drunk driving. See? And after the seventh, I said, that's it for me. I'm not going to jail. I'm not going to pay the fines. I quit my job. I left the lady. I left the kids. I always wanted to be a drug dealer. When I was in prison, I thought that was really a cool thing to do when I got out, you know. So I finally decided to do that. And I went to a connection, the guy that I was in prison with. And he goes, yeah, I got this stuff. And he gave me a big old pile of this crank, you know. He goes, don't use it. I said, I won't do that, you know. So there I went. You know, I lived in San Pedro at the time. And I shouldn't say, I'm from Pedro. I'm not from San Pedro, you know. And so I said, I left, I got the drugs, and I'm getting out of town. And I moved to Long Beach, which is about 11 miles away. And over two bridges. You know, that's it. I'm in Long Beach, you know. So all of a sudden, you know, I got all this money coming in. I'm real cool. I got this big old hat and stuff. And I think I'm really cool. And I'm driving this big old Cadillac. I got a Cadillac, you know. And one day, they knocked my door down. And I got a warning before I got there, see. The guy told me, hey, you know, Vince, the knocks were at your house, they knocked your door down, you know, in your apartment. And, you know, so I didn't go, and I had that big Cadillac, you know, and that's how it started. I got the Cadillac, and fortunately had a big back seat. I ended up sleeping in the Cadillac. And my sponsor used to always tell me, you know, it gets worse, and then it gets worser, and it gets worser. And that's exactly what happened. I started driving a Cadillac, trying to deal in drugs. Then all of a sudden, I lost the Cadillac, and I'm on a moped. I'm on a moped, you know. And I'm living in the park. I'm on a moped. And you see the guys with the baseball caps, you know, backwards? I invented that. Back in 1972, you know, 70, what was 70, 81 or something, you know, and I had to be on that moped, and I'm six feet tall on that little moped, and I look like a giraffe going down the street, you know. So then it got worse. And then I'm walking. See? I lost the moped. I'm walking. And I migrated from Long Beach to Malibu and all the way back to Pedro. It took me 3 years to make that journey, you know, from the Cadillac to the moped to walking. And, you know, today I play golf. I love to play golf, you know. And I lived in all kinds of different places. It didn't matter. And at this one place I used to live, it was an apartment. And then it had a gully. And then I used to live, not in the apartment, but in the gully. And I had a little cardboard box, you know, and I had my moped there at that period of time. And it was right next to this ninth hole on a golf course that today I play maybe about twice a week. And as I approach that green, on the ninth green, I don't forget where I came from, you know, at least two or three times a week. And then I came all the way back to Pedro. And we talk about God in Alcoholics Anonymous. We talk about praying. We talk about answering our prayers. We talk about praying for somebody else. We talk about praying for ourselves, maybe. And, you know, God answers all of our prayers. I don't care where you're at. It doesn't matter if you're in stinking county jail somewhere, or if you're at home in your bed somewhere, or if you're out in the street walking around somewhere. I'm sitting on the corner of Palos Verdes Drive North and Western Avenue in San Pedro, and nobody knows where that's at unless you've been down there. But I'm sitting on a curb, and I see this couple walking down the street with holding hands, and one's got a kid in each hand, and they're walking up the street. And I just blurted it out loud and said, God, I sure would like to be like those people. And, you know, I didn't know at that period of time that was a prayer. You know, that was a prayer. 2 days later, I'm in the park on Western Avenue. And that was a park that I used to play in when I was a kid. And I don't know why I ended up there, because I just knew when the heck I was going there. And I was there about 3 weeks. And a couple of days after that incident on the curb, I'm walking down Western Avenue, and all of a sudden this pickup pulls up. I knew one of the guys. I didn't know the other guy. One was David Fox. The other guy was Henry Gilliam. And they pulled up and asked me, where are you going, Vince? What are you doing? You could tell I was on the street. I had this little big old beard and I had burrs in it, you know. And, you know, I had this my world-famous leather jacket on. I think I'm really cool with this jacket. It's 105 degrees outside, you know. And I'm sunning. One time I'm laying in the park and this gal comes up to me. Or I woke up and she's standing and I looked up at her and I knew her. You know, and she looks and she backs up and could tell I'm on the street. And I go, Jeannie. And she goes, Vince. And I get up and I go, give me a dime. So I call a friend of mine. And she goes, here, take two dimes. Call all your friggin' friends. You know, everybody knows but us. You know, everybody knows but us. Eh? So I come out of that park, and these two guys are in the pickup. And they ask me, Vince, where are you going? And what are you doing? And one of the first times in my life, I answered truthfully, and I says, I don't know where I'm going. I don't know what I'm doing. And they didn't ask me if I wanted to stop drinking. They asked me if I wanted a place to stay. And, you know, I said, yes. You know, and they took me to the Claire Foundation in Santa Monica, which is kind of like a recovery home thing, you know. And, you know, I don't know. The best thing I know how to do is drink. You know, most of us, the best thing we know how to do is drink. And so I'm there a couple of days in this detox center, see. And after a couple of days, I think I'm okay. I get my little shoebox. I got a little shoebox. That's all my belongings, you know. And I got them under my arm with my leather jacket on. And I'm going to bolt out that door. And I get to the threshold of that door. And there's a desk right there, which is a counselor sitting there. And this lady that was there, as I get to the door, she goes, Vince, she yells at me, get your ass back in here. Man, I'm 47 years old at the time. I grab my little shoebox. I run back inside of my bed like a little kid. Okay, man, you know. I ran back inside. I was like emotional, about 12 years old inside, see. And I'm not alone in that spot when we get here, see. I know that. And I've been here ever since. I had no intention of staying in Alcoholics Anonymous, not even at that period of time. I had no intentions of doing the steps, doing what I'm supposed to do. Had no intentions of talking to anybody. Had no intentions of being sober. And I got out of there. I went into the Claire Foundation. I worked in the thrift shop. And I went to a meeting. My first meeting outside of there was, I'll tell you a little story before I get into that, is the fact that most of us, before we came in an Alcoholics Anonymous, were probably touched by somebody or some person or something that was associated with Alcoholics Anonymous. And we didn't know it until we got here. And we got a little moment of clarity, and he goes, oh, that's what they were talking about. Dummy. You know, but the whole deal was, see, that happened to me. I was a pretty good athlete when I was young. I was a good basketball player and played baseball, and I loved sports. I knew what to do when I was on the court. I knew what to do when I was on the baseball diamond. I knew what to do on the football field. But I didn't know what to do when I was off of it. But what happened is I was going to play basketball in my senior year. Basketball, it was all, you know, sports is everything to me, everything. And what happened is this teacher failed me. She failed me. I didn't fail the class. You know, we are pointing the finger at everybody. But what happened is it made me ineligible to play basketball in my senior year in high school. And it devastated me. And she gave me the report card. And on it was a paper clip. And I never forgot it. It said, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And I go, what is this bullshit? So I went to my first meeting outside of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a couple of things happened there that night. The speaker, I knew from years in prison, and right behind the speaker was that serenity prayer. And this was 30 years later. And the first thing that came to my mind was, that goddamn teacher was a drunk. And that's why she failed me, see? But the guy that I got drunk with, shot dope with, did whatever, you know, was in prison, walked the yard with the guy, you know, God put somebody in right in front of me, you know? And now, I went up to Woody that night. His name was Woody Woodward. And Woody says, damn, blah, blah, blah. He told me about another guy that was in prison that was sober and another guy that was sober. And I couldn't believe it. The next day, these guys came by to see me at the Claire Foundation. And they just walked me through this goddamn program in the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous when I got here. And I know that God put me those guys in my life because I could understand what they were talking about. I could not understand what anybody else was talking about. You know, from 1972 to 1984, when I got out of prison for the last time, until I got an Alcoholics Anonymous, I was still talking out of the side of my neck. And I still thought I was a convict. And those guys took me and held my hand and took me to meetings and showed me how to live and showed me what the heck to do. And I understood what the heck they were talking about. And what happened is then I finally had to get a sponsor. I asked four guys to sponsor me prior to that, and nobody wanted to sponsor me. Everybody told me no. And the next guy I asked, the fifth guy I asked, he told me no as well. And I walked out of the meeting, and I was so upset. You know, I thought for sure this guy would say yes. And the next week I went to the meeting, and he was leading the meeting. And I didn't want to even stay there, and I sat there anyway for some reason. And he calls on me first. You know, I said, I don't have anything to say. And then what happened is I talked to him later. He comes up to me, says, I got somebody went out and drank, man. I got time for another guy. And that guy's been my sponsor till he passed away 6 years ago. And Don was the kind of sponsor. Don Adams was the guy's name. The kind of sponsor he was, he gave me a lot of rope, see. He gave me a lot of rope. And I was the kind of guy that if you talk to me and say something, I don't listen. I never listen. The guys that I asked to sponsor prior to that, they knew that. They said, man, you ain't going to listen to me. So Don was... I just don't know how to explain it. He was like a meeting junkie, and he took me to every meeting. He had a construction business, and they call it the half-a-day construction business. So at 12 o'clock, he went to a meeting. And that was it. He went to another meeting. And he just pulled me away, pulled me with him and with him and with him and with him. And after about 6 months, he told me, Vince, you got to start sharing at the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, you're not doing anything. So the next meeting we go to, we're sitting there, and he gives me that bam on the side, see? Bam, and chomp, and I go, bam, my hand goes up. And he goes, you. And I go, my name's Vince. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for letting me share. You know, he puts his arm around me. I get choked up with this. But he put his arm around me and gave me that little man tug, you know, the little thin man tug, you know. And he said, Vince, you did good. Nobody told me I did good before I got here, see. Nobody told me I did good. Why did you do that? Since I was like a little kid, 5 years old. I always had that temper. You know, I was always angry. I was angry when I was a kid. I was alcoholic way before I took my first drink. I had the ism. I had that anger. You know? Don't mess with Vince and the family. Don't mess with Vince because he gets mad, see? And I was the kind of person, an alcoholic, that when I get hurt, I want to hurt somebody else. See, that makes me, I used to think that made me feel better, see? And that's how my life went from then. When I was a little kid until I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was angry all the time. Everybody was wrong. I was never right. Everybody was wrong. So I was raised in San Pedro, you know. My dad was a commercial fisherman. My mother was a housewife. And my mother didn't have a full deck. She was, you know, in and out of sanitariums all her life. You know, in those days, you know, nobody, you know, she was abusive. And you know, my dad was a pretty kind man. He was a pretty nice man. But he was never around. My mother was never around. My brother and I were bouncing around in the family all the time with relatives, you know, aunts, uncles, and whatever, you know, and that's how we were raised. And what happened is my brother and I became real close because of that. And we always used to be like together, 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 you know. I'm of Croatian descent, you know, I'm full-blooded Croatian, actually, if you don't know what that is. You know, but anyway, there's a lot of Croatians in San Pedro, and what we did we used to maintain the European customs, you know, and one of them was to make wine every year. And what we did was, you know, we didn't make a couple of bottles. We made big vats, you know, of wine. And what happened is when, you know, when I was 10 years old, it was my turn to go in the vat and squash the grapes. And I was defiant. And I didn't want to get in there. They had a literally push me in there. And I'm in there squashing the grapes, and they're seeping through my toes, and I couldn't stand it, you know. So that next summer, we're having a party at my cousin's house, you know, my aunts and uncles, and you know, my cousins are sitting in the corner of the backyard, and they tell me to come on over here. What are you doing? And they got this jug and some cups, and they go, here, have some of this. I go, what's that? They go, that's the wine we're making. And I go, oh, okay. And so I took my first drink, and it went down, and I'm 11 years old, and it felt like, what's going on? Boom, give me another one. You know, 11 years old, man, I want another one, see? And even before I took that drink, my parents or somebody took me to the store and asked me if I wanted a candy bar, I wanted two. I wanted two candy bars. I wanted two of everything, you know, even before I took that first drink. But that's what started it then, see. That's what took my first drink. That following summer, I was the first one in that vat, man, because I knew what happened after that, you know. I was right in there squashing them grapes, man, and it felt good, you know. I loved it on my feet and stuff then, you know. And that's how crazy we are, see. Well, I say we, I mean me, because somebody's going to come up and tell me, I never felt like that. Well, so, you know, I could mention, you know, my brother and I were really close, and a lot of things, you know, happened in our family that were not good, and you know, unlike my wife, man, I was not raised by a real happy family, you know, and you know, I went the wrong way, then my dad left, you know, and things like that happened, you know, the thing that happened in the high school with the basketball and stuff, and then I went on a different path, you know, and I started getting in trouble, you know, when I was young, and then one day I got, you know, I got married, and, you know, right away I had a couple of kids. I went to jail and I come out, and, you know, I had another kid, and then I have two daughters, you know, when I'm young, and then what happened is my brother was a really good football player, you know, and he was staying with my wife and I during one summer after he got out of high school. So my dad kept us away from the fishing boats. You know, he didn't want us to fish. He wanted us to be lawyers and doctors and stuff like that, you know. And he didn't know he raised an alcoholic, you know. but what happened is my brother got a job on a fishing boat, you know. You know, he was 18 years old and he needed some money. And I said, yeah, go ahead. And my dad was out of town. My mom was out of town. You know, I let him go on this fishing boat. You know, he got killed. You know, the three guys were in the boat. They had a small albacore boat, and they all got killed, you know. It was painful for me. I mean, it just killed me, you know. I didn't know what to do. See, I didn't know have any tools to cope with any kind of that stuff, you know. So what I did was I drank. I got mad, you know, and I tried to hurt somebody, see. And I had mentioned earlier about the fight in the bar, and that's how that happens. Yeah? I did hurt somebody. I ended up in San Quentin. You know, so, you know, my story, I don't know what time I stop here. I've got 10 minutes, maybe 15. Is there any timer here? Okay, kick back, man, because I can talk now, you know. You know, when he jabbed me in the side of the head and I rose my hand, and all I said was, thanks for letting me share. Well, you know what? That's over. Pull up a chair. The guy sitting in the barn, come on out here. Get closer. You know? So that happened I got a couple of prison stories, man. I feel comfortable tonight, so I'm going to talk about them a little bit, you know. And when I went to San Quentin for 7 years, we're from Tulare County. There's Oildale's part of Tulare County, right? Is that correct? Yeah. Merle Haggard. Yeah. We're in the same gated community at one time. And he used to strum his guitar in the lower yard in San Quentin. You know, and he liked baseball. That's why I knew the guy. I was a big baseball player in San Quentin, you know. And Merle was used to sit down and strum that guitar, you know, all day. He wasn't famous then. You know, he got famous later. But anyway, one of the things that happened in there was the fact that, you know, I became a different person, you know. I let the stuff I just got caught up in it, you know, and sometimes you can't help it. You need to survive, you know, and what occurred was, you know, that there was a guy that was, that when we were younger and another time when I was in jail, and his name was John Swayze, and this guy used to cry every night, you know, and I just told him, John, don't cry, man. These guys will step on you, you know. And I had, like, compassion for the guy. So he'd cry, and I'd make noise so nobody could hear him crying, you know. And we ended up in San Quentin together. And after there about a couple of years, we just said hi to each other, how you doing? And then one day, you know, you hear in the movies, you know, it gets real quiet in there, and, you know, something's going to happen. So it was real quiet. We're standing in the chow lines, you know, and it got real quiet, and all of a sudden, you know, everybody just separated. And there was this guy, John Swayze, with a knife stuck in his stomach, you know. And I was 2 feet, 3 feet from the guy. I turned around and walked away, see. I didn't reach out to say anything. He looked at me, and that's how I had become. You know, I become a different person. And, you know, that gives you an example. And then a couple other things happened, you know, when I was 19 years old, I went to a Soledad State Prison, and there was like 19 of us guys that were youth, we were all 19, 20 years old, and we went to Soledad State Prison, and you know what they do, hey, Bubba, you know, Bubba's coming along, you know, so all of us 19 guys were, you know, we protected each other, you know, we didn't want to do what they wanted us to do, you know, they were, of all the 19 guys that were there, I was the only one that didn't get hit on, see, after I got an Alcoholics Anonymous, did my fourth step, I found out I resented that for a long time, you know. You know, I always thought I was a pretty good looking kid, you know. But they didn't, I had that scowl on my face all the time. See, even the convicts didn't want any part of me, you know. They didn't, everybody kept me at arm's length, you know. You know, I ended up going to Vacaville State Prison as well. Might as well share this as well, you know. You know, that's the nut house, actually. It's not they call it the California Medical Facility. And, you know, I'm in there the first couple of weeks, and I'm sitting against the wall, and these guys are, you know, they're nuts. You know, they're, you know, like this. You know, and the only time they stop moving around is when they get their pills in the pill line, you know. And they're running up and down the hallway, and then I'm talking to this guy, and I go, look at these guys. You know? Look at these guys, Pat, they're crazy. He goes, hey, Vince, in 6 months you'll be running up and down the hallway with them, you know. And sure enough, that's what I was doing, you know. And a couple of things happened in there. I was in a therapy program there, and I was in a stress unit program there, and it was like demanding, you know. I had a therapist that was a lady in a wheelchair, you know, she saw something in me that I didn't see and let me know about it, you know. And, you know, we're all good inside. I don't care who you are, you know. We all got something good inside us. And she showed me that a little bit, see. But it didn't stop me from drinking. It didn't stop me from using. but I was a little bit of a better person, you know. And, you know, we get in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we do the steps, and we discover that we're an alcoholic after we do the first step in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we do the second step, we do the third step, we do the fourth step. And, you know, I feel about doing the fourth step is kind of like, you know, we've got a lot of garbage inside. And we kind of discover this and we share it with somebody else and we let this garbage out. And what we're really doing, in my opinion, is we're uncovering the God that's deep down inside each and every one of us, you know, and we can let that out. We can see God and see what's happening and find out that we're a good person inside. You know, we're not bad people. You know, we might drink and do whatever we do, but we're not bad people inside. And what happens is we get rid of that. We got to make a psychic change, man. That's an obvious thing that tells us in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. But we got to make a psychic change. And the reason for the psychic change is the fact that so that we reach out and grab that first drink. Because once we reach out and grab that first drink, we're dead and stinking. I don't care who you are. I don't care if you live in the biggest house in the world or the lowest house in the world. You take that first drink, man, you're just like everybody else. You're a stinking drunk. And that's what we do best is drink. See? So you got to do the rest of the steps. You know, you got to do 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, you know. And I've done them 3 times because I'm a 3-time loser as well. So the fact is, like, you know, nobody is perfect. We're not perfect people, you know. There's something wrong with everybody. Everybody makes mistakes. You know, but we have an opportunity to clean them mistakes up. See, that's why we make amends. That's why we let other people know that what the heck was wrong with us, you know. And that's why we help other people, you know, to make ourselves a better person. And we can't help anybody else unless we do the 12 steps in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's only one way to do it, as far as I'm concerned, is in the first 164 pages in the big book, you know. Every time you say that, hey, you know, you take somebody through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's true, because you learn something yourself each time you do it. You know, you don't qualify unless you can do it. And if you're new and you're looking for somebody to do it, find somebody that's been through the big book in the first 164 pages so they can take you through it and let you know what the heck's going on. You can't do it yourself. See? How many smart people do you see coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and they memorize things and they... You know, we had a guy in Pedro, his name was Frederick, and he couldn't get sober. You know, but he could memorize the 5th chapter, the 3rd chapter, part of the 3rd chapter, and he could recite the 12 traditions verbatim up here at the podium. But he couldn't get sober. You know, he was a smart guy, but he couldn't make that psychic change. I used to pick him up walking down the street. He'd be all battered up. And I said, what happened to you? He goes, I got mugged. I said, who in the hell's going to mug you? You don't have anything, you know. You know, somebody beat the, bam, bam, beat him up, see. He died in the street. He died in an alley in San Pedro, drunk, see. And that's what happens to us. You know, it's not pretty. You never see a drunk that's dying, that's in a hospital or in some bedroom with his relatives there helping the guy pass away. You find him in an alley somewhere, in a goddamn flea bag, motel, hotel, or whatever. You know, it's ugly. If you drink and you die, you're by yourself. And you make that choice. So, you know, I got 5 kids. And I like to say that I got a relationship with 3 of them. And the other 2, the oldest ones are, we're not perfect. You know, we just, you know, they just never forgiven me. You know, they just, that's just the way it is. You know, sometimes they come back, sometimes they don't. And, you know, my kids today are the ones that I do communicate, and I got grandchildren, and I spent time with them, and I'm able to do that. I couldn't do that before I got an Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't communicate with people. I couldn't communicate with my relatives. I remember when my dad, he passed away after I was about a year sober, and he had the big C, and then we had a big thing, and I remember he told my stepmother, he says, you know, the best thing that happened to me at that period of time was that he said he's finally got his head screwed on right, see? And that's what our family's like. Their families don't like us drinking. You know, they like us sober. They like us with our head screwed on right, see? So, you know, I have a daughter. Two of them were in the program. One thinks that she's not an alky, so she went back, and so far she's been okay for the last 3 or 4 years, but you never know what's going to happen. And I have another daughter just celebrated 10 years of sobriety on May the 5th this year. And, I'm going to tell you what happened with her, because it's a good Alcoholics Anonymous thing. You know, she got busted and went to prison. And she's there about a year and a half, and she tells me, you know what, I want to do the steps, Dad. And I said, man, I don't want to know about you. I know enough already, you know. She goes, take me through the steps. And I go, nah. What about Tori, my wife? And she goes, I go, nah, not her either. So I called a friend of mine. It happens to be my sponsor today. I called her, and he goes, I know a lady, and she was in Malibu, in a camp in Malibu, my daughter. And this gal, I contacted her, and she banged on that door in Malibu, in that prison, for a year. She banged on that door and got in there to go see her and take her through the steps on a Saturday. I'd go and see her on Sunday. She'd see her on Saturday, you know, and that's how Alcoholics Anonymous works. You know, it's like you never know where people are going to reach out for you, you know. And I'm grateful for that today. And I have a son that has two grandkids, who has two kids, you know, and they're the ones I spend most of the time with. I've always had trouble with relationships, you know, and I'm always like, I used to be always looking for my next ex, you know, and I was just one of those, you know, and things happen in your life where you get better, and then all of a sudden something happens and it gets good, see. And, you know, I need to mention the fact that, you know, my wife was a speaker before me, and that's the way it's always going to be because I have more sobriety. but anyway, what happened is we had an Alcoholics Anonymous wedding, you know, but what happened is that, first of all, you know, we're together, how long have we been together now? You know, we've been together 23 years, or be 24 years in a couple of weeks. And But what happened is, you know, after a couple of years, you know, we moved in with each other after a year, you know, we're dating, and we moved in, and then all of a sudden, after a couple of years, I go, Tori, and I say, you know, we ought to get married, you know. And she goes, no way, you know, I'm not getting married, you know. So she got that little thing about marriage, and then after about 5 more years, we're still together. She goes, you know, Vince, we ought to get married. And I go, too late. But anyway, we got married, and Tori had never been married before, but it was like we had an AA meeting. We did all the standard stuff. I got asked her for her hand in marriage, you know, and I went to her mom and asked her mom for her hand in marriage, and we just did all the cool things, you know, and I'll never forget it. The day we got married, like, I never seen the wedding dress. We did all that kind of stuff, you know, and she come walking down that aisle, and man, she was an angel, you know. It was like the best thing that ever happened to me. You know, best thing that ever happened to me. We'll celebrate 16 years in August, you know. But relationships have always been a problem for me, and we had to work on a lot of stuff. But the whole deal is basically, if you're worrying about if you got a partner or whatever's going on, we never go to bed angry. Never. It's one of the things, you know. And usually it's her who gives in first. So I'll be honest about that. So, you know, this is a great event. You know, this is a great event. You know, I appreciate being able to come up here and share my story with all you people, you know. And I met a lot of good people. And we're having a really good time. Like Tori had mentioned, that we're going to stay an extra day. But the whole deal is, you know, like, family does not like us drunk. They don't like us drinking. And you know what? They know better than we do what the heck we're doing. See? We lie so much that they just know we're lying all the time. When I was the daughter I was talking about that has 10 years of sobriety, when she was about 12 years old, I was in between relationships at the time. And my daughters, and I got four daughters, and they always wanted me to be with somebody because they think dad needs a girl so he'll be okay, you know. And we went in this market one time, and we had to get this one item. And Sabrina was with me, and we're walking in, and this gal's coming down. It's the summertime. She's got this halter on and these hot pants, and she's got, you know, with her basket. She getting in line, and Sabrina goes, "Dad, get in line behind her." He goes, "That's your style." I go, "You got that right." You know. She goes, "I'll go get the item." So she runs over and gets the item. I get behind the girl and I go, "Hey, baby, no." So she pushes the basket up and takes out a 6-pack of Lohenbra, a bottle of champagne, a bottle of wine, so I don't say anything. And that the stuff goes on up, and Sabrina comes running up with the item and throws it on the conveyor. And it goes around like this, and she sees the booze. She goes, "Dad, no, no." So anyway, they don't like us drunk. They like us sober. You know, and God willing, I hope that all of us stay sobriety forever. Thank you.